happened to come up with this data on your daughter, says William Sullivan, who led the FBI's Domestic Intelligence Division under Hoover. From that time on, the senator's right in his pocket. For decades, politicians feared Hoover would collect and leak such information, intended to give him what he wanted and not to cross him. The FBI also covertly leaked its political intelligence to the news media in order to influence social policy and political action in accord with its preferences. The Church Committee, a Senate Intelligence Committee formed in 1975 to study intelligence abuses found. Sometimes it conveyed distorted and exaggerated facts to the media to support its political goals. Deep state sabotage is close to the type of deep state activities that some on the right decry today. There were many institutional reasons why deep state abuses occurred in that era, but two stand out. First, the deep state lacked legal regulation. Practically no statutory laws governed deep state activities inside the United States, and intelligence agencies simply ignored the Constitution, concluded the Church Committee. William Sullivan told the committee that in a decade on the U.S. Intelligence Board, he never once heard or asked the question, is this course of action which we have agreed upon lawful? Is it legal? Second was the absence of transparency within the government behind walls of secrecy. Congress exercised no oversight, and senior members of Congress frequently told intelligence officials not to inform them about intelligence activities. There was not much more oversight within the executive branch of FBI and NSA activities, especially in the FBI, where presidents gave Hoover significant leeway to run his own ship. With no one with adverse interests watching carefully and internal responsibility blurred, abuse flourished. The deep state abuses of the 1950s through 1970s came to an end with their revelation in the early 1970s and with the 1976 Church Committee report, which documented them publicly. The resulting reforms can be described as a grand bargain. The president and his intelligence bureaucracies were allowed to maintain robust surveillance and espionage capacities, including in the domestic arena. But in exchange, Congress imposed significant legal restrictions on how they collected, analyzed, and disseminated intelligence information. A bevy of lawyers, and later inspectors general, monitored and enforced those restrictions. Domestic surveillance required a court order, including an order from a new court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court for Foreign Intelligence Collection, and two new committees, the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, were to be kept fully and currently informed of all significant intelligence activities and were granted robust oversight authorities. The hope was that public oversight mechanisms could be replicated in secret by imposing legal restrictions, enhancing internal transparency, and creating multiple channels of accountability. The grand bargain was successful in stamping out the political abuses it aimed to address. In the four decades after the Church Committee, there has been no evidence that presidents and senior executive officials have used the deep state to attack political enemies or subversive forces in the United States. Ironically, Edward Snowden's leak in 2013 of information about U.S. signals intelligence practices confirmed the success of the grand bargain. Snowden revealed the massive scope of U.S. signals intelligence collection at home and abroad. He also revealed a new and serious post-Church Committee problem, the rise of secret legal interpretation by executive lawyers and secret courts that can distort the meaning of public laws in ways that allow for intelligence collection against Americans that departs from public expectation. But Snowden also showed that the political abuses of the pre-1975 era were gone. In many thousands of pages of highly classified material about numerous domestic collection programs and practices, not one pointed to anything like the political operations of the 1970s and before. The grand bargain's imposition of legalism, process, and internal transparency also had a significant, though more ambiguous, impact on deep state sabotage of Democratic official action. None of the many intelligence revelations in the last few decades reveal anything like a concerted bureaucratic effort to exercise control over politicians or Democratic policies akin to what Hoover's FBI did. One often reads that a president who betrays or fails to support intelligence agencies faces a threat of retaliation. But to the extent this has been true, it appears to be a species of typical bureaucratic resistance to presidential initiatives that cut against the bureaucracy's interests. Also, in recent years, intelligence agencies have sometimes been accused of skewing the information they feed a president, an accusation that is hard for the public to assess. The point for now is that we have never returned to the days in which an intelligence bureaucracy deployed its tools to, in effect, blackmail or threaten to destroy democratically elected officials, and thereby control them. But there is a large caveat to this conclusion. A form of political sabotage that the grand bargain did not stop, and indeed a practice that has grown in the years since the Church Report, is leaks, or threats of leaks, of secret government information to achieve various ends. In the sabotage scenario sketched thus far, a national security bureaucrat discloses, or threatens to disclose, secretly collected information to harm the political principle for ends deemed abusive. Hoover shenanigans are an example. But a member of the deep state can also leak secret information or threaten to do so to sabotage the political principle in ways we deem virtuous. A classic pre-Church Committee example is Mark Felt, the associate director of the FBI, who was Bob Woodward's infamous deep throat source for the Watergate revelations. Felt worked in the FBI for over 30 years and was heavily involved in its secret illegal actions, for which he eventually was convicted. But he was also deeply offended that the president and his top aides ran what constituted a criminal operation out of the White House, and he risked everything to guide Woodward. It is sometimes hard to say precisely when and why opportunistic use of secret information to sabotage Democratic leaders is deemed virtuous, felt against the Nixon White House, as opposed to abusive, Hoover against scores of politicians. Felt was acting individually and taking personal risk, while Hoover was acting with the support of and on behalf of the FBI and taking less personal risk. The bureaucracy as saboteur might pose a greater threat to democratic action than an individual acting alone. It also might, in the right circumstance, be a more effective savior. Felt might also be seen as a whistleblower who was exposing corrupt and illegal action by the government, while Hoover was an opportunist who was undermining democratic processes. Felt's case is relatively easy to defend, because he disclosed no classified information, and because he was ratting on one of the most corrupt presidencies in American history. A fuller assessment of virtuous sabotage must consider two complications. First, what if a deep state agent leaks to expose corrupt or illegal action in the face of a criminal prohibition on the disclosure of that information? In that case, the intelligence official is acting illegally and contrary to the considered views of the political branches about the importance of maintaining secrecy. Can two wrongs make a right? And second, can we trust the deep state leaker to leak the right kind of information? How can we be sure that the interests and judgments of deep state leakers will, as in Felt's case, serve the national interest? On the first question, it is pretty clear that, despite prohibition on leaks of classified information, the optimal rate of leaking such information to sabotage elected officials or their policies is not zero. The president has complete control over the secrecy stamp, and he and his subordinates sometimes deploy it opportunistically to keep illegal or otherwise wrongful action out of the public realm. When the executive branch acts in the secret world it defines for itself, it may make more mistakes than usual, and any mistakes it does make are harder to correct. because the grand bargain is only a second-best solution to public transparency and accountability. Moreover, fear of leaks causes national security officials to think twice about what they do and deters them from doing things that they should not do. Finally, the proof is in the pudding. Leaks in the early 1970s revealed atrocious deep state practices that led to the major reforms in the grand bargain. Numerous leaks of classified information in the last 15 years on matters ranging from black sites to interrogation to surveillance to drones have disclosed practices deemed illegal or illegitimate by Congress, courts, or executive insiders, which proceeded to impose reform. In all these cases, sabotage via deep state leaks performed a vital corrective. This is the sense in which the deep state's manipulation can be a savior of democratic politics. It can preserve democratic values through the revelation and correction of anti-democratic action in secret. The objection that the government, through democratic processes, has considered the matter and spoken through criminal laws that prohibit leaks of classified information turns on an inaccurate picture of U.S. law. The general legal prohibitions on leaking classified information found in the century-old Espionage Act are old and full of loopholes that make many, and perhaps most, damaging leaks impossible to prosecute. Congress has considered but not closed these loopholes. Despite the recent press panic over leak investigations, the government prosecutes only a tiny fraction of leakers, and many it stays away from because they would be politically controversial. The government is even more hands-off with the press, even though journalists publish much more classified information today than in the past, and with a lowered threshold of when such information is in the public interest. It has never prosecuted a member of the media for publishing secret government information. It sometimes, though rarely, subpoenas journalists to assist in leak investigations. But under political pressure for restraint, the Justice Department has twice, in recent years, raised the hurdles to such subpoenas. A journalist in this situation can be jailed for refusing to reveal sources, but recently the Justice Department declined in a high-profile leak prosecution to force a journalist to testify against his source. One reason the government constrains itself in punishing leakers and their publishers is that leaks of secret government information are not always an absolute bad, and indeed can serve a vital function in checking a too secretive deep state. To say that deep state leaks of classified information are sometimes justified is not to answer the second question about whether we can trust leakers to know which leaks are appropriate. Some leaks are intelligence operations by foreign adversaries. Those are viewed to be uncontroversially bad. But even when leaks come from ostensible whistleblowers, they can be enormously costly in terms of national security harm, lost intelligence, blown sources, and significant financial investments ruined, especially when electronic surveillance techniques are disclosed. Unfortunately, we don't have great conceptual tools for measuring these costs and benefits or for determining optimal trade-offs. The public lacks adequate information to really understand these harms, and intuitions about how to measure and trade them off vary widely. There are nonetheless plenty of reasons to think that leakers across the run of cases will lack adequate information, or proper incentives, or the right values to get the trade-off right. Even those who see themselves as whistleblowers have many complex motivations and aren't reliable judges of when the benefits of leaks outweigh their costs. Sometimes they are right, but often they are wrong. Some leakers, for example, misperceive the legality or legitimacy of government action. This happened with the leaks published by the New York Times in 2006 about how the government worked with a global banking consortium to collect financial information related to possible terrorist-related transfers. The author of the story, perhaps reflecting his source's motivation, defended it on the ground that it rested on a largely untested legal theory and was arguably extra-legal. This judgment was simply wrong. The program violated no American privacy laws. It operated by administrative subpoenas pursuant to powers that Congress delegated to the President in the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. Other times, leakers will misperceive the public interest value of the leak compared to its national security harm. We know this is so because American newspaper editors, who carry a heavy presumption in favor of publication, sometimes refuse to publish leaked classified information after weighing the value of publication against possible harms disclosed by the government. And then there is the complicated case of Edward Snowden. Snowden worked at the margins of the deep state actor. He was technically a contractor, not a bureaucrat. Although private sector growth in the intelligence area has been significant enough to approach deep state status in terms of what the intelligence contractors do and their distinctive and persistent interests and attitudes. Like Felt, but unlike Hoover, Snowden acted alone rather than on behalf of the bureaucracy. And in contrast to Felt, Snowden aimed to hold accountable not just a president, but the entire intelligence community. Snowden's leaks can roughly be divided into two types of classified information. 1. Surveillance practices inside the United States or involving American citizens. And 2. Surveillance practices outside the United States involving non-U.S. citizens. The leaks of practices in Category 1 were the easier to justify because the practices were controversial under U.S. statutory and constitutional law, were contrary to public expectations, and sparked reforms, and broader conversations about reforms. One could even argue that Snowden's Category 1 disclosures helped U.S. intelligence agencies by forcing them to be more transparent, by demonstrating that despite the legal controversy, they were acting with the full knowledge and support of all three branches of government, and by sparking reform that strengthened the legality and legitimacy of their domestic collection practices while barely narrowing them. By contrast, the leaks of surveillance practices conducted abroad, against non-Americans, revealed operations that were lawful and consistent with general expectations, inside the United States, about U.S. intelligence agencies' activities abroad. Tellingly, these Snowden disclosures have not yet sparked significant changes to U.S. law. But they had a huge impact. They blew many sources and methods, caused enormous financial losses, severely strained relations with allies, and revealed to key adversaries, including China and Russia, how we monitor their activities. Snowden has justified his actions primarily on the basis of the oath he took to support and defend the Constitution. If so, he made a big mistake, since the practices he revealed did not violate the Constitution. Snowden might have been serving his oath when he leaked the Section 215 domestic metadata program, and also, perhaps, the aspects of the 702 programs, PRISM and upstream collection, that concerned U.S. citizens. But it is hard to see how Snowden's oath to the U.S. Constitution justified the theft and disclosure of the vast number of documents, probably more than 99% of the total, in Category 2 about overseas activities that did not even arguably violate the laws or Constitution of the United States. Snowden's actions in Category 2 also reveal how the leaker may have whistleblowing motivations that cannot be credited within the U.S. political system. Although Snowden has defended his actions, mostly based on his oath, he has also suggested that he was motivated by cosmopolitan values to protect the privacy rights of foreigners and a free internet. But this motivation is antithetical to the very idea of a national intelligence service, whose job is to collect foreign intelligence, including by electronic means. There are any number of principles that it may be proper for national security bureaucrats to serve. The president, the constitution and laws, the American people, the bureaucracy itself. But foreign citizens and governments cannot be a legitimate principle. No country can maintain an intelligence service and credit leaking for cosmopolitan ends. In sum to this point, First-generation deep state threats of political abuse and a bureaucratic, as opposed to individual, sabotage of government policies for illegitimate ends seem to have dissipated after the grand bargain. But leaks by individual officials have continued and indeed proliferated with the growth in the secrecy system that the deep state manages. Although we don't have great metrics for assessing these leaks in every case, there are examples when the leaks serve valuable ends on balance, and other examples when they don't. Leakers cannot be trusted to get this calculus right. But nor can the government be trusted to sort out and regulate deep state leakers in ways that clamp down on the bad while maintaining the good, even assuming the government had the power to stop the leaks, which it doesn't, except at the margins. And so the U.S. government muddles through with a massive secret intelligence bureaucracy that collects unfathomable amounts of information in the domestic realm, but is unable to control its leakers, who, for better or for worse, possess enormous discretion to use the secretly collected information to sabotage persons, policies, and initiatives they do not like. The deep state has been blamed for many things since Donald Trump became president, including by the president himself, though he has not yet used the term deep state. Trump defenders have used the term deep state promiscuously to include not just intelligence bureaucrats, but a broader array of connected players in other administrative bureaucracies, in private industry, and in the media. I will continue to focus narrowly on the intelligence bureaucracies that conduct and use information collected secretly in the homeland. There is significant evidence that the deep state, so understood, either as part of a concerted movement or via individuals acting more or less independently, has used secretly collected information opportunistically and illegally to sabotage the president and his senior officials. The hard questions are whether this sabotage is virtuous or abusive, whether we can tell, and what the consequences of these actions are. Since Trump was elected, unusually sensitive leaks of intelligence information designed to discredit him and his senior leadership have poured forth from current and former intelligence officials in the deep state. The first major one, in February 2017, concerned a court-approved NSA wiretap of a phone conversation between Russia's ambassador to the United States, Sergei Kislyak, and incoming National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, that concerned, among other things, the possible removal of Russia's sanctions imposed by President Obama. Flynn had denied that the men discussed sanctions, and the leak revealing his lie led to his resignation. Another major leak concerned communications intercepts during the campaign of Russia government officials discussing potentially derogatory information about Trump and top campaign aides. Other leaks in this vein included intercepts of Russian officials claiming they could influence Trump through Flynn, of Kislyak supposedly informing Moscow that he discussed campaign-related issues with then-Senator Jeff Sessions, and of Kislyak discussing in a communication to Moscow that Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, wanted to communicate via a secure channel. These leaks probably marked the first time ever that the content of foreign intelligence intercepts aimed at foreign agents that swept up U.S. person information was leaked. They clearly aimed to damage U.S. persons, ones who happened to also be senior U.S. government officials. They were unlawful, and beyond that, they violated two, until now, strict taboos about leaks. First, on revealing the content of foreign intelligence information collected through electronic surveillance. And second, on revealing the content of incidentally collected information about American citizens. The leaks were, at least in some respects, more damaging than Snowden's leaks, which involved information about programs, but not discrete conversations that violated the privacy of the communicants involved and did not contain means and methods of intelligence collection at the level of granularity of the Trump-era leaks. Many people, including many who are not in the Trump camp, have interpreted these leaks to violate a third taboo by marking a return to the Hoover-era FBI's use of secretly collected information to sabotage elected officials with adverse political interests. The comparison is plausible in light of the extensive efforts soon after the election to encourage the bureaucracy, including the intelligence bureaucracy, to resist the Trump administration, and the evidence that there was, in some agencies, such resistance. We don't know if the leaks have come from uncoordinated deep state individuals or via coordinated action akin to the type Hoover engaged in from the top of the FBI. It might be something in between. Moreover, while Hoover did many awful things in quiet, neither during his reign nor at any other time in American history have we seen such a profusion of sensitive leaks from the deep state with such an overtly political aim to bring down senior leadership. Mark Felt's leaks may perhaps be the equivalent, but as noted above, they were not unlawful and did not involve the most sensitive and guarded classified information that the government possessed. The Felt example raises the possibility that the anti-Trump leaks, on their face, political and unprecedented, were nonetheless justified whistleblowing, akin perhaps to Felt's leaks or to leaks about illegal surveillance programs or about illegal interrogation practices at CIA black sites. Put another way, it is possible that the benefits of the leaks, considered narrowly, outweigh the evil inherent in breaching the first two taboos above. The situation the leaks are a response to is itself extraordinary to the point of unprecedented. The acting Attorney General of the United States, Sally Yates, believed that Flynn, the new National Security Advisor, was compromised by the Russians and vulnerable to blackmail, and so warned the White House, which seemed to take no steps in response to the information. More broadly, a number of very odd circumstances suggested unusual and potentially corrupt connections between the Trump campaign and administration and the Russian government, about which the FBI had been conducting a counterintelligence investigation since the summer of 2016. All of this came in the context of the unprecedented Russian DNC hack, designed, our intelligence agencies tell us, to help Donald Trump win the election. And then once in office, President Trump himself engaged in vicious, and in many instances, false attacks on the intelligence community and Justice Department investigators. Do these unprecedented circumstances justify the unprecedented deep state leaks? As I write in September 2017, we don't have enough information or adequate consensus about how to judge illegal leaks, to assess costs and benefits here. The lines crossed by the deep state leaks against Trump were thought to be absolute ones until 2017. But we have never faced a situation in which the National Security Advisor, and perhaps even the President of the United States, presented a credible counterintelligence threat involving one of our greatest adversaries. Perhaps the facts will develop to give us enough clarity about the Russia-Trump connections to be able to make a better judgment along the lines of the judgment history has made about Mark Felt's leaks. Though, perhaps, we will never have adequate informational clarity, and thus won't be able to reach consensus on whether the leaks were justified. But however those matters develop, the whole ordeal has already done great damage to both the presidency and the national security bureaucracy. One important question going forward is whether the taboo on leaking the content of foreign intelligence collections is broken, and to what degree, and what the consequences of that breach are. As deep state officials get a taste for the power that inheres in the selective revelation of such information, and if the leaks are not responded to with severe punishments, it is easy to imagine the tools that brought down Flynn being used in other contexts by national security bureaucrats with different commitments and interests. Even the most severe critics of President Trump should worry about this subtle form of anti-democratic abuse. As Adam Klein asked, "If you welcomed these leaks because they hastened Flynn's departure, Would you be comfortable with selective leaks of U.S. person intercepts becoming a routine weapon in political catfights? With an unelected, permanent state wielding this power to undermine or intimidate politically accountable officials? With political appointees using it to sideline rivals or attack political opponents? It was very hard and very damaging to eliminate the various forms of surveillance abuse that prevailed in the pre-church days. The actions of the deep state in the early Trump days, exacerbated by the president's own actions, threatened to take us back to that time. The big loser in all this will probably be the national security bureaucracy itself, and, to the extent it is weakened, the security of the American people. Even if it turns out that Flynn and others close to Trump were in the bag for the Russians, many people will for a long time view the anti-Trump leaks as political abuse of intelligence to harm political enemies. This perception will be deepened by the Trump administration's relentless and often false attacks on the integrity of the intelligence community, including its false suggestion that the original collection that incidentally captured Flynn's communications, as opposed to the leaks of such information, was illegitimate. The Flynn and related leaks didn't just violate the law. They violated the core commitment the intelligence community made in the grand bargain not to politicize or appear to politicize the use of surveillance tools or the fruits of their use. The whole intelligence collection system, which has an importance that far transcends its undoubtedly large importance in this discrete context, is vulnerable here for the simple reason that the intermixture of politics with intelligence collection is the intelligence system's Achilles heel. If surveillance comes to be seen through a domestic political lens, with domestic political winners and losers, the intelligence community will have a very hard time acting with needed public credibility, and that, in turn, means it will have a harder time doing what it needs to do to keep us safe. How We Lost Constitutional Democracy. Tom Ginsburg and Aziz Huq. Washington, D.C., November 2024. For the second time in three election cycles, a populist billionaire has won an Electoral College majority to become President of the United States. Drawing a cue from her recent predecessors, she has campaigned in fiery tones, demonizing liberals, threatening to shut down the universities that shelter them, and to lock up the ghetto thugs and radical Islamic terrorists they defend. She promises to restore American pride and power, and take back our country from radical ruination. After a feckless 4 years of divided government, in which crime upticked, the economy stagnated, and America's place in the world seemed to decline, the country's citizens respond to the president-elect's unequivocal promise of law and order. And, as she happens to own the largest media conglomerate in the country, that message finds its way to many ears. Upon taking office, the new president seizes a moment of unified government to systematically consolidate power over other branches and civil society. Unlike her predecessors, she does not antagonize the courts. Instead, she handpicks allies for key judicial vacancies and looses an army of Ivy League-trained lawyers to draft each executive order and to explain how her innovations are consistent with the framers' original understandings. In response, judges double down on existing doctrines that command deference to the executive's policy choices, enable the use of coercion, and impede scrutiny of the motives behind such action. A cottage industry of legal scholarship mushrooms, celebrating the efficiency and optimality of this new judicial restraint. As her party in Congress bickers, substantive legislation continues to be rare, and executive orders have become the modal form of new law. Even when constitutionally commanded, the congressional role has withered. The appropriations and budgeting processes are largely driven by the president's agenda. On the regulation front, Congress enacts an umbrella statute known as the Authorization of Regulatory Force and Adjustment, affectionately known as ARFA, that delegates to the President the power to take all necessary and appropriate steps he or she deems necessary to streamline regulations, notwithstanding any prior laws passed by Congress. Citing the White House's unique democratic mandate and credentials, the Supreme Court upholds this delegation. Using its newfound regulatory power, the executive branch consolidates many government functions into the White House, creating a system of policy czars, including a gaggle of so-called princelings, who are close friends and family of the president herself. Congress repeals the Hatch Act and enacts the Holman Rule into law. The latter, formerly an 1876 House budget rule that allowed federal employees' salaries to be reduced to $1, is aggressively used to purge non-loyalists from the bureaucracy. Citing theories of the unitary executive and presidential administration, the president claims the same power as a matter of inherent authority, and soon federal agencies are almost exclusively populated by those personally loyal to the new commander-in-chief. On another front, the president urges her congressional majority to change the terms of the Federal Elections Campaign Act, so that members of the two major parties alternate years serving as chair of the Federal Elections Commission, such that the president's party holds the chair during even years. Coincidentally, all national elections are held in even years. Meanwhile, the Internal Revenue Service steps up audits of media companies that compete with the president's company, along with not-for-profits providing legal services to regime opponents. Periodically, the national security agencies anonymously leak transcripts of opposition politicians' compromising communications, often containing salacious details of extramarital affairs or sexual peccadilloes. Outside of government, the president's media empire also turns on individual civil servants and the residual few federal judges not aligned with the White House. Those who resist her policies or her growing cult of personality are flagged in a nightly Twitter blast about the enemies of the people. A sympathetic judiciary relaxes First Amendment constraints on libel and slander awards and also permits punitive damages in such cases. Two national newspapers on the East Coast are forced into bankruptcy by litigation costs and awards of damages. 3 years later, a lone terrorist commits a suicide attack at an NFL game. On the evening of the attack, the president stands in the stadium's still smoldering entranceway to announce a new raft of restrictions on social media and un-American religious associations. She further explains that she will seek a constitutional amendment repealing the 22nd Amendment, which limits the president to 2 terms in office. State-level gerrymandering has given her a comfortable 2/3 majority in both houses of Congress. Privately, some members of her party are dismayed, but they are too intimidated by the president's power and media empire to openly resist. The amendment sails through the otherwise demanding ratification process. A year later, the president joins Franklin Delano Roosevelt as the only persons to serve more than 2 terms in office, sworn in on a Bible held by her princeling son-in-law and presumptive heir. Dystopian fictions of the kind we have just sketched have their guilty pleasures. We squirm with recognition at Offred's plight, or quiver in admiration of Winston's resistance. But dystopian fictions, like their utopian counterparts, have a serious end. Just as Margaret Atwood, in writing The Handmaid's Tale, sought to rely solely on repressive measures she had culled from human history, our less eloquent exercise has relied on legal and institutional changes that can be observed in one or another national context in which some backsliding away from democratic values has already occurred. Indeed, the real reason we begin with this unhappy tale is to ask, what is it, precisely, that prevents the same steps from unfolding in the United States? And would what we have described amount to a failure of democracy? 2 years ago, many might have responded that the scenario we have sketched was too far-fetched to be imaginable. The United States has the world's oldest democratic constitution still in force. Beyond the relatively thin text of the document, there were norms of political practice, settled conventions within federal institutions, and robustly independent courts that would inhibit any attempt to permanently consolidate power. Despite the Civil War, two world wars, and countless economic and security emergencies, national elections have never been postponed. Britain, by contrast, canceled elections during World War II. To be sure, there have been dark moments. President Abraham Lincoln unilaterally suspended the writ of habeas corpus in May 1861, as war with the South was beginning. As Jeffrey Stone's Magisterial History of the First Amendment documents, anti-war activism was effectively criminalized in World War I, changing the parameters of the political sphere in important ways. Human and civil rights have been violated during many other crises, and we have a dismayingly long history of disenfranchising, excluding, and subordinating racial minorities. However, despite all this, we lack a history of wholesale corrosion of the three main pillars of our democratic institutions: elections, the rule of law, and freedoms of speech and association. As a result, we lack the historical experience needed to evaluate the current risk to key national institutions. One reaction to this history would be to ascribe the U.S. Constitution a measure of prophylactic power. The thesis would be that democracy has thrived in the United States because of the distinctively effective design of the Constitution in buffering that practice from external and internal threat. The argument would gain strength from observing that the rest of the world has not been so lucky. In the past decade, an increasing number of seemingly stable, reasonably wealthy democracies have retreated from previously robust democratic regimes toward autocracy. These states are literally all over the globe. They range from Eastern Europe, Hungary and Poland, to the Mediterranean, Turkey, to Latin America, Bolivia and Venezuela. Once anticipated democratic gains in Russia and China have failed to materialize. Meanwhile, a hoped-for fourth wave of democracy in the Arab Spring's wake has dissipated into bitter civil war or charismatic authoritarianism. Democratic backsliding is far less rare than political scientists used to believe. In recent scholarship, we have identified 37 instances in 25 different countries in the post-war period in which democratic quality declined significantly, even though a fully authoritarian regime didn't emerge. That is, roughly one out of eight countries experienced measurable decay in the quality of their democratic institutions, without fully collapsing into dictatorship. Scholars used to argue that democracy, once attained in a fairly wealthy state, would become a permanent fixture. As the late Juan Linz put it, democracy would become the only game in town. That prediction turned out to be merely an aspiration, rather than a reality. As a result, the global trajectory for democracies, as opposed to partial or complete autocracies, does not look positive. Although we are not yet at a moment in which democracies are rare, as in the 1970s, it is quite possible that what Samuel Huntington called the third wave of democratization has peaked. The recent de-democratization trend is worrisome. Of course, we should not take for granted the assumption that experiences in other parts of the world matter for the United States. At least since the time of Alexis de Tocqueville, commentators have argued that our country has a distinct and robust democratic tradition, and our people a uniquely democratic temperament. Indeed, the phrase American exceptionalism was first used in U.S. communist circles in the 1920s in the course of efforts to explain the apparent immunity of U.S. democracy to the lure of proletarian revolution in the wake of World War I. American exceptionalism has since become something of a national credo, in the fashion of the earlier notion of manifest destiny. It is hence all but obligatory, at least in the context of public political debate, to say that the founders created a marvelous system of checks and balances that would defeat any attempt at a power grab. But a careful study of other countries' experiences, in light of the legal resources contained in our own Constitution, suggests that such complacency is unwise. The United States is not exceptional. It is instead vulnerable to the most prevalent form of democratic backsliding, the slow and torturous descent toward partial autocracy. In one regard, those who worry about an overreaction to President Trump are correct. A sudden and dramatic end to democracy in the United States, for example, through a military coup, is highly unlikely. Coups, of course, still happen. In May 2014, for example, the Thai military suspended that country's constitution and ended democratic rule. A year earlier, the Egyptian military ousted then-President Mohamed Morsi in favor of General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. By contrast, an attempted coup against Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in 2016 failed, although it did paradoxically precipitate an acceleration of that country's rush toward autocratic consolidation. But despite these high-profile examples, coups are in fact increasingly rare. A 2011 study of democratic backsliding identified 53 historical cases of democratic decline. Out of those, only 5 involved coups or other sudden collapses into authoritarianism. What's more, since the 1950s, coups have become increasingly infrequent, and they usually take place in a context quite different from the American situation. Full-on democratic collapse tends to occur in recently established, relatively impoverished democracies, in which civilian control of the military is tenuous. None of those conditions apply in the U.S., despite economic problems such as rising inequality. An alternative to the military coup is the rapid asphyxiation of democracy using emergency powers. Deployment of such powers is not uncommon. From 1985 to 2004, 137 countries invoked state of emergency procedures at least once. Commentators who worry about President Trump's behavior after a terrorist attack have something like this in mind. It is certainly true that the Constitution lacks the careful restrictions on emergency powers of the sort that other countries' constitutions employ. The latter typically place crisp constraints on the length and scope of extra-constitutional behavior, and they name the constitutional actors who must sign off on the emergency measures. Contrary to the arguments of Carl Schmitt and his legatees, these exceptional powers have not necessarily proved unworkable or inimical to ordinary politics. But the U.S. Constitution contains no such provisions. Instead, American presidents and judges have inferred vague emergency powers into many of the Constitution's key clauses and phrases, such as Article 2's reference to the president as Commander-in-Chief. The latter, which might have been understood principally as a means of assuring civilian control of the military, is also understood as a basis for the president's power to respond to sudden attacks, but also as a more diffuse authority to act unilaterally on national security or foreign policy grounds. Similarly, the president's power to take care that the laws are enforced has experienced a kudzu-like creep, as both Democrats and Republicans invoke it to justify expansive executive power outside the emergency context. Coupled to these constitutional claims are broad statutory delegations, such as that under the 2001 and 2012 authorizations for the use of military force. These provide sub-constitutional foundations for aggressive claims of presidential power in the United States and beyond, and have become ingrained in our law. It is simply a contingent matter of judicial doctrine that more specific language is required in the domestic realm. Paradoxically, what seems like a drafting failure in the Constitution may also work to democracy's advantage. The very fact that government has a great deal of legal discretion in responding to perceived crisis, often to the detriment of important liberty and dignity interests, means that there is far less plausible justification for calling off the regular processes of elections in order to deal with the crisis. But one of the lessons of recent comparative experience is that the quality of democracy can decline precipitously even as formal elections continue to be held. The most important reason that the sudden collapse of democracy is rare, and the key reason it is unlikely in the U.S., is that a sudden derogation of democracy simply isn't necessary. Would-be autocrats have a cheaper option at hand, one that is far less likely to catalyze opposition and resistance: the slow, insidious curtailment of democratic institutions and traditions. One reason we expect that democracy will end only by way of a crisis or a sudden turning point is because we are quick to assume that the narrative of political life will track the arc of fictional accounts of political upheaval. Fiction is dominated by dramatic moments of clarification and revelations, victories and defeats. But real life is not like House of Cards. There need not be sharp inflection points. Indeed, it is worth reflecting on the fact that democracy, even in its thinnest sense of mere competitive elections, relies on transparency, legality, impartiality, and constraint. These are promoted by a range of different laws, norms, institutions, and individual loyalties. All of these rarely vanish at once. Their slow evaporation may be ineffable and easily missed. To understand this form of democratic backsliding, it's important to understand the essential components of a democracy. First, there must be elections, which must be both free and fair. Elections by themselves are not enough. Both Russia and China, after all, have elections that formally reflect the choice of the people, but allow only limited choices. Second, democracy needs liberal rights of speech and association, so those with alternative views can challenge government on its policies, hold it accountable, and propose alternatives. Finally, democracy can't work if the ruling party has the courts and bureaucracy firmly in its pocket. The rule of law, not just the rule of the powerful and influential, is essential. Take away but one of these attributes, and democracy might wobble. Sap all three, and the meaningful possibility of democratic competition recedes from view. It is here that comparative experience proves salient. It is possible to examine other countries that have experienced various forms of democratic backsliding to understand the specific legal mechanisms and institutional changes that are employed to unravel democratic practice. By comparing the resulting toolkit of anti-democratic devices to the institutional safeguards of democracy contained in the U.S. Constitution, we obtain some traction on the question of whether our organic document has indeed served an effectual prophylactic purpose. That comparative experience shows that would-be autocrats find it critical, first, to control the public narrative, often by directly attacking or intimidating the press. Libel suits — Vladimir Putin, for example, recriminalized libel after it had been decriminalized in 2011 under Dmitry Medvedev — drummed up prosecutions, and vice-like media regulation accomplished the same ends. A mogul who controls powerful media, such as Italy's Silvio Berlusconi, has an extra advantage of being able to crowd out other voices from the national stage. Contrary to hopes expressed in the early days of the Internet's development, new forms of social media may have made it easier, rather than more difficult, to obtain a practical hegemony over the terms of national debate. Conjuring or overemphasizing a national security threat creates a sense of crisis, allowing would-be autocrats to malign critics as weak-willed or unpatriotic. The underlying crisis can be more or less real, and may or may not impact the jurisdiction in tangible ways to affect the tenor of domestic politics. In Hungary, for example, Viktor Orbán has carefully invoked the Islamist terrorism and the migration crises to cement his popular standing, notwithstanding the fact that Hungary is not in the crosshairs of either crisis. There are other common rhetorical moves that can be loosely characterized as populist in character. Leaders who wish to roll back democratic institutions, for example, tend to depict those institutions' defenders as representatives of a tired, insulated elite engaged in self-dealing to the detriment of the people. In contrast, such leaders portray themselves as embodying the uniquely authentic voice of the people. Here, Trump is illustrative, as we cannot resist citing a claim he made in a May 2016 political rally that captures the core of this logic. "The only thing that matters," he said, "is the unification of the people, because the other people don't mean anything." A second element of democratic backsliding is a systematic effect to dismantle the plurality of national institutions. In particular, institutions tasked with maintaining the rule of law, or that provide a foothold for oppositional politicians, are targeted quickly. Comparative experience suggests that an independent judiciary and institutional checks, such as legislative oversight of administrative activity, can prove significant barriers to democratic backsliding. Hence, we often see would-be autocrats trying to pack the courts or intimidate judges into getting with the program. When the state bureaucracy insists on rule of law norms, they too must be bullied into submission. Weakening civil service tenure protections is an underappreciated way to accomplish this. When government workers hired on the basis of merit are elbowed out and replaced by loyal partisans, this not only removes one potential source of opposition to the executive branch, but it also enables a would-be autocrat to direct formidable prosecutorial and investigative apparatuses against political foes. The recent fraud conviction of Putin opponent Alexei Navalny shows how such tools can be used against an opponent who threatens to amass power through electoral popularity. Finally, political competition must be staunched, even if elections proceed in some form as a way of enabling leaders to claim a mantle of legitimacy. Modifying presidential term limits is a common move, but so too are changes to the ground rules of elections in order to permanently lock in temporary majorities. To witness the full panoply of these measures being deployed against democracy, there are no better contemporary case studies than Hungary and Poland. In a startlingly short time frame, populist governments in both countries have straitjacketed independent courts, dismantled independent checks on political power, used regulation to muzzle the media or stack it with cronies, and conjured supposed security threats from immigrants and minorities as a justification for centralizing power and dismantling checks. In Hungary, the Fidesz government used constitutional amendments to entrench its slim, 53% majority, beyond easy electoral challenge by changing the composition and operation of a previously independent electoral commission. The result was that in 2014, it won two-thirds of the parliamentary seats with 45% of the vote. Fidesz also changed the composition of the Constitutional Court and created a new National Judicial Office. It also strengthened the Prime Minister's control of supervisory bodies, such as the Electoral Commission, Budget Commission, Media Board, and ombudsman offices. Incumbent officials were removed to make way for Fidesz loyalists, who have facilitated the rise of what Orbán calls, intending the description as praise, illiberal or non-liberal democracy. The Polish Law and Justice Party, PIS, elected in October 2015, began its tenure by selecting 5 new judges for the Constitutional Court, while refusing to swear in 3 other judges who had been properly appointed by the previous government. 2 months later, the PIS-controlled Parliament enacted an amendment to the Constitutional Tribunal Act, requiring a 2/3 majority on the court in order for its decision